from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. With the country focused on a government shutdown and America's southern border, we're going to shift our attention to a different immigration story. A new documentary short, Lifeboat, highlights the plight of refugees and migrants who flee the coast of Libya under the cover of darkness. Director Skye Fitzgerald joins us to discuss his Academy Award shortlisted film, Lifeboat. Welcome, Skye Fitzgerald.
I'm so happy to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Glad to have you here. We also join in studio by Emily Arnold Fernandez with Oakland-based Asylum Access. They work on refugee issues around the world, and welcome to you.
Thank you.
Glad to have you both aboard here. And, Skye, let me begin with you, and let's begin by talking about actually, well, the film is, of course, what I want to talk about, but this is part of a trilogy. You did a film back in 2015 called 50 Feet from Syria, and that could have led you to the flight of refugees in this new film in a very clear kind of trajectory. But with concern about the whole humanitarian issue, I mean, these are people who are fleeing war and oppression and poverty and torture, persecution, and so forth in rubber boats. And we know the stories are that so many of them simply don't make it.
Yeah, that's true. That is the stark reality that refugees are facing in the modern global world, you know. And the whole idea behind the trilogy, of course, was to try to bring that to light in a different way. And as horrible as the conditions that refugees are facing in many parts of the world, I felt like it was important to sort of look at that horror as a filmmaker and somehow try to make it beautiful, because I felt like if we can make it beautiful somehow, it allows us to bear witness and sort of see and acknowledge it in a new way, and would sort of prevent us from looking away from it, to sort of make the unwatchable watchable, to confront it.
Yeah, you have.
That's sort of our overarching goal of the entire trilogy.
That I understand is your intention, and it's a good one. It's a very humane one. It's also, I think, clear in watching your movie that there are heroes in this. There are, you know, Germans in Sea Watch, volunteers, and there's also John Castle. And I'd like we can talk about John Castle in a moment. He was a Greenpeace activist. The name is probably recognizable to many of our listeners. But let's hear a cut early on from the film.
The further away you are from a problem with humans, the easier it is to rationalize and just see them as a problem. The closer you get to the problem, like a car crash or something, then it's not just a mass of people, then they're separating into individuals. And then they've actually got different expressions on their faces. Then you have to start dealing with them as people. And then your heart starts operating more than your head.
That's John Castle, who was a skipper of the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior. And he kind of epitomizes what you were saying there as your intention, Skye Fitzgerald. That is, he looks at these people as people, and suddenly things change.
Yeah, John Castle was an absolutely remarkable human being, in my view, and one that, despite his passing, continues to inspire me as a human being to do more in whatever way I can. And I think he inspired many people. He was a sort of a beacon of light, a human being who lived by his principles, very simply on a boat off the coast of England, and volunteered as a captain with all sorts of organizations over the course of his long career.
Well, there's hope in this civil society intervention that I alluded to before. You've got these volunteers from Berlin, and they have retrofitted research, essentially bringing out people who are refugees. The problem is, and I think you stated this, is you try to save one, and then you save another, and another, and another, and it becomes impossible in many ways, even if you have the most extraordinary intentions and the greatest sense of your own humanity. And then there's the problem of sustainability, and I want to get to that with you, because as much as people can empathize with what these people are fleeing from and the horrors that they've endured and the need to find their way to Europe, countries are creating barriers and countries are fighting nationalism and all the rest of it, because there's a real problem assimilating them and absorbing them, and resources have to be used and all that. Let me have you say something about that.
About the sort of recent far-right movement in the EU?
Well, before we get to that, and I do want to get to that as well, but the whole question of sustainability, whether you see it all from Islamophobia and xenophobia and so forth, you can also understand in many instances countries being unable to take that number of refugees in.
Yeah, that's true. And that speaks, I think, to the scale of the crisis that we're currently facing. Right.
Exactly.
Now. I mean,
yeah.
The global refugee crisis is, you know, it's the greatest number of displaced human beings since World War II. And I don't think our institutions or our civil society organizations are very well equipped, frankly, to deal with it. And so, you know, it's going to take our nation states. It's going to take our leaders, and it's going to take people like John Castle and organizations like Sea Watch and Asylum Access to change it over time. And there's systemic issues, obviously, that come to bear on this. You know, the motivations of people on the boats that we filmed off the coast of Africa were many. Right, some were fleeing war from Syria, some were fleeing conscription. And others were economic migrants who, of course, were taking a life risk knowing that they could die at sea simply because they chose not to try to raise their children on a dollar a day for the next 20 years. And so there is many reasons why people try this journey. And I don't think as a global community we've done a very good job addressing it well yet.
Well, you've separated refugees from economic migrants. It's an important separation, I think. But Emily Arnold Fernandez, let's go to you on this. I was reading an article in The Guardian by Diane Taylor, and she says the real crisis is, with the refugees at least, is the European politicians are not able to really do what needs to be done, that it's a political failure, as the United Nations has even said, as well as a local failure. But this question of sustainability hovers over this whole debate and has to be addressed.
Absolutely. But I think it's important that we start that question of sustainability from a place of fact. And despite the media coverage and what we might think, you know, in the media, we hear more about Greece and Germany than we do about Libya and Lebanon. But most refugees don't reach Europe. And to be honest, wealthy countries, Europe, the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, in general, are not really doing their fair share. As Sky says, the greatest number of people displaced by war, conflict, persecution since World War II is what we're confronting today. And in 2017, Turkey was home to 3.5 million refugees. Pakistan was home to almost 1.5 million. Uganda also home to almost 1.5 million refugees. Meanwhile, the U.S. was home to 287,000. The United Kingdom was home to 121,000. Germany, close to 1 million. But Germany has a population of 82 million people and is hosting slightly less than 1 million refugees. That's fewer than Lebanon, which has a population of 6 million people. One in every six people in Lebanon is a refugee. So I think it's a fallacy to say that the wealthy countries in Europe and the U.S., North America, cannot do more. I actually think that the statement that this is a political failure and not a failure of resources or sustainability is absolutely correct.
Well, it's also been described as an ongoing, unimaginable horror that people are really trying to find different safe harbors from. And it's more deadly now in many ways than it used to be. That's the irony of it. I mean, we have this image, many of us, as a Syrian toddler on the Turkish beach, and things were so terrible then. And then the EU started putting on all sorts of curbs or what they thought were prophylactics and things of this sort. But it's maybe, in the Mediterranean at least, the argument is it's more deadly now.
Yes, absolutely. More refugees. Refugees are continuing to flee because they're fleeing for their lives. And so putting up barriers, making it difficult, doesn't stop people from coming. It just makes it more dangerous for them to come.
There's a moment in the film that Sky Fitzgerald, director of Spin Film, his new documentary Lifeboat has, where young refugee from Africa says there are only two choices here, life and death, and that's really what they're up against. Let me give out the phone number. I know many of you may want to weigh in here, listeners, and have questions not only about the film, but really about the whole ongoing crisis, and it is a crisis. I don't use that word at all hesitantly. Our toll-free number is available, and the number to call is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program, so please feel free to be a part of it. Again, join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We've got Sky Fitzgerald on with us, director of Spin Film. New documentary is called Lifeboat. And here in studio, Emily Arnold Fernandez, who is, executive director of Asylum Access. Lifeboat, by the way, will be screened tomorrow at 7, I'm losing my voice here, at Landmark Embarcadero in San Francisco. you know, we take our voice for granted. Somebody's going to have to bring me some water. Let me go back to you, though, Emily. Oh, she's giving me some water here. Thank you. That may have done it. I hope so. I keep bringing up the sustainability question because I think it weighs on Europe. We talked about the move from the right and the right moving in nationalistic fashion and in exclusionary fashion and everything. What to counter that? Again, local politics?
Well, I think one of the things that can counter it is simply encounters between people and positive encounters between people. Some of these positive encounters will happen naturally if you have people living in community, living together. You'll see a mom with her kid in the store, and whether she's wearing a hijab or an African traditional outfit or a, you know, German traditional clothing or Levi's, you're going to see that she's caring for her kid the same way that you as a parent would care for her, for your kid. But I think also there can be efforts to intentionally build community. And there's some organizations that we know and that we collaborate with that do a very good job of this. Welcoming America is one that has done some work in communities here in the U.S. and is now expanding to Germany. But there are others as well. And in fact, in our work in Mexico, we have built something called the Hospitality Route, which is bringing together members, community leaders, whether they're in nonprofits, whether they're part of local government agencies, whether they're religious, and helping them understand who are the refugees in our community, what are their needs, what do they bring? What do they have to offer? And how do we connect with them? And we bring them together with refugee communities. And we found that this has built bridges for employment. This has built bridges for local government services. This has built bridges of friendship and collegiality between people. And I think that has to be part of our solution.
It's certainly consistent with your vision of things, Sky Fitzgerald. In fact, you paid for this film yourself, didn't you?
Yes, I did. The volunteer team that created it is the same team that was responsible for the first film of the trilogy, 50 Feet from Syria. And they also volunteered on this one. So all the practical costs, with the exception of one small grant from Mountain Film, I just paid for on a credit card.
Let's hear from our listeners. Let's begin, Amy, with you. You're on, Amy. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you.
I am grateful for your program. I'm actually heading down to teach a seminar at Stanford on the history of borders and migration in the British Empire starting tomorrow. So I might actually kick off the class with some of an excerpt from your segment. But my question is for Emily from Asylum Access. I was wondering what your thoughts are about the possible expansion of the category of asylum from a narrow definition of political asylum to a broader category of economic and climate refugee status. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Let's go to Emily.
Or either more broadly.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Amy. Emily?
That's a great question, Amy. And, you know, right now, the category of refugees includes people who are fleeing for religious reasons, because of their political opinion, because they have the wrong skin color or belong to the wrong clan or family. So it's fairly broad right now, and it also includes, in many cases, people who are fleeing from generalized war or violence or situations where the state cannot protect them or will not protect them. So I think the current definitions, at least under international law, are relatively broad and need to be applied in that broad way by states. And so some of what's most needed, I think, is to ensure that states have the right system set up, particularly for the 85% of refugees who live in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Latin America. We need to be focusing on ensuring that those countries have the right kind of laws, are identifying refugees correctly, are granting them the rights to work, to put their kids in school, to take all the steps needed to rebuild their lives. In most cases, that's not happening yet. It's started to happen. You've started. Jordan has a pilot program offering work permits to refugees. Uganda has been very progressive in this. But these are isolated incidents. So I think the real question about refugee law is less about expanding the current definition and more about using the current definition in its most expansive way. That said, there's some very important work being done by academics on these questions of survival migrants. Are there people who are forced to migrate who don't fit into our existing categories of protection? And I think those are very important questions as well. And as you mentioned, people who are forced to flee by extreme poverty or famine, people who are forced to flee as a result of climate change, those are important and emerging categories in international legal scholarship. And I enjoy being part of those conversations, and I look forward to seeing that develop. But I also think there's a lot more that we could do with our existing laws. Almost nowhere are refugees granted the full range of rights that they are entitled to on paper under international law.
Emily Arnold Fernandez is Executive Director of Asylum Access. You bring up international law here. The human rights laws are very clear, especially as presented by the United Nations and in the Charter of the United Nations and so forth. And Skye Fitzgerald, you guys your crew actually saved some lives, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We did. there were, on the second day of the mission, our 30-meter vessel encountered over 3,000 people floating in the middle of the ocean. And we were the only search and rescue operator in the area at the time. And over the course of the next 2 days, 16 people successfully pulled over 3,000 people out of the ocean and transported them to an EU transport vessel. And the amazing thing about that is that of those over 3,000 people, only two died. One woman who is shown briefly in the film, and then there was one gentleman who drowned before our Zodiac could reach them.
That's amazing, to me, especially in light of the statistics that we have. About 1 in 18 make it through.
That's right. And so that's inspiring to me, right, that it can be a civil society invention in that way. But back to the systemic issues, the situation has changed dramatically in the southern Mediterranean since we filmed Lifeboat. And probably the best way to articulate that is that on the mission following ours, there was a distinct change that happened where the EU decided to start funding some groups. And so Sea-Watch went out in the same search and rescue area, and they encountered a boat just like the ones shown in Lifeboat. And right as they were about to initiate the rescue, the Libyan Coast Guard showed up and intervened, and one of the Libyan officers boarded the boat with a club and proceeded to walk down the middle of the vessel, beating the asylum seekers as he went in order to get at the outboard motor, which is worth about 5,000 euros. And during the course of that, 23 people fell out of the boat and perished. And they perished because the Libyan Coast Guard was pointing a 50-caliber machine gun at the Sea-Watch crew, not allowing them to intervene, all for the price of an outboard motor. And that is the entity, the Libyan Coast Guard, that the EU is currently funding to solve this problem in the triage area off the coast of Libya. And that's a real problem.
It's a real problem. Obviously. We don't even know who's in command in Libya from one day to
that's
the
right.
next.
I mean, absolutely.
It's such a decentralized and chaotic and maybe in many ways simply the center will not hold type of government. I want to get another caller on here, and let me go to you next. Mitchell, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call. One of the issues that I'm hearing a lot just as Americans in general talking about immigrants is when they come, what are they going to do? Are they going to become Americans? Are they going to try and change America to become their little country? You know, how I feel like we have to change the way that Americans feel about immigrants in order to support these laws better in the future? And what are some ideas about that?
Well, there are a lot of ideas that have been floating around here. We're talking about Europe, of course, but do you want to address that at least in a broad way, Emily?
Sure. I think that, you know, there are people who are much more expert than I am on how you change public opinion on the right kinds of marketing and campaigning. But I think we could look to the countries that do host much larger numbers of refugees. What have they done? What's been successful there? I think we're so used to looking to the U.S. and Europe for answers. But as I said, the U.S. and Europe host a tiny, tiny fraction of the world's refugees. And there are countries that are hosting many more, doing tremendous work to respond to this global crisis of displacement. And I think we can look to those countries for what's been successful. How have refugees been integrated, included? How have societies been able to adjust the way that they respond to welcome strangers? And I think if we do that and we build on the research and knowledge that we have here about how to change opinion in the U.S. or wherever in Europe, if that's where we're talking about, I think that combination of those two things can give us some of the answers.
Again, Emily Arnold Fernandez is Executive Director of Asylum Access. Let me go back to you, Sky Fitzgerald. Let's talk with you about the individuals that you were able to know who were coming over here. I mean, you've been emphasizing the importance of seeing them as individuals and getting a sense of their humanity. Can you make some sense of generalizations that people will understand about who these people are and what you got from them? I mean, they all have different stories,
sure.
I realize.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah. Sure. So we interviewed many asylum seekers on the search and rescue vessel during the course of filming, and you know there were lots of different stories, but there was a lot of resonance between them. So there was a good portion of the asylum seekers who were actually Syrian, who had the wherewithal and the resources to escape Syria. To Cairo, to fly to Cairo and then go overland into Libya to exit via the Zabrata and the other beaches. So that was one sort of demographic. But the larger demographic, of course, were refugees from northern Africa, from conflict areas and non-conflict areas, who were coming to Libya because it's a fractured nation state, right? And their stories were all incredibly similar in terms of what they experienced. And it was basically that as soon as they crossed the border into Libya, they were trafficked because in chaos, darkness can reign, I guess. And they were trafficked, put in detention centers, and we heard story after story of the women being abused and raped, of the men being turned into virtual slaves. We interviewed one gentleman who was forced to work in a rock quarry with a sledgehammer for 2 months and paid nothing. And all of them echoed the same fact that they weren't able to be released from these different forms of detention until they were able to secure enough funds from their families in their countries of origin in order to be released. And this was all before they had a chance to risk their lives on these rafts leaving the beaches. So the horror is real, and that's why it's so disturbing that now Libya is being paid so much money to try to solve the crisis when they really don't have the resources or are equipped to do it.
Sky Fitzgerald is director of Spin Film. His new documentary is Lifeboat, and it will be screened tomorrow, 7:30 p.m. at Landmark Embarcadero in San Francisco. And here's another caller. Stephen, join us. You're on the air, Stephen. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for putting me through. My question is for anyone who's willing to answer it. What do you think the countries of Spain and Morocco can do to help with the African refugee crisis, specifically in the cities of Ceuta and Melilla on the African continent?
Emily, you want to handle that?
Well, I think that that border cities are always the first line of defense. I know that there have been some really innovative moves by cities. I can't speak to those two in particular, but I know that there have been some really innovative moves by cities to find ways to respond to refugees who are either moving through or staying. And I think one thing that is important to recognize is that there's no city that is simply a transit point or simply an end point. And so any solution that these cities are adopting will need to understand that some people will move on and others will stay, and to look at, you know, what's the right balance of being able to provide people with assistance in a temporary way and creating those systems that Sky keeps emphasizing that will make it possible for people to rebuild if they choose to stay.
If you're going to have a humanitarian and life-saving focus, there has to be some compliance with these international laws of human rights that we spoke of earlier. But how can you get nations, sovereign states, to really comply? I mean, I think it has to be, in many ways, an emphasis on compassion and humanitarian impulses and turn those into, in some cases, they're just putting up borders or putting up fences and so forth, and they're just not letting refugees in, period.
I think we can look to the humanitarian arguments, the moral arguments. We can look to the legal arguments. Many of these countries have signed up to the Refugee Convention. They chose to do that. It's like a contract. If you sign it, you should follow it.
But they're not following it. That's the point.
Right. And what I think is actually stronger is to provide the self-interest arguments. When you look at the countries that are hosting the largest numbers of refugees, allowing refugees to work and to participate in the economy and society has a wide range of positive effects. And in fact, when refugees are allowed to work, within 5 years, they're having a positive economic, a net positive impact on the economy. So yes, at the beginning, people are going to need to figure things out, get themselves settled. But within 5 years, they're building your economy, they're starting businesses, they're hiring people. And if we can look at arguments like that, if we can look at what are the realities of the choice to include refugees rather than exclude them, rather than drive them underground, people are still coming to Europe. They're not going to disappear. People are still coming to countries in Africa. They're not going to stop coming simply because you put up barriers. But if you drive them underground and they're working illegally, they're getting kidnapped, they're getting trafficked, they're getting exploited, that's going to be bad for everyone.
Ongoing debate. Thank you. Good to have you with us, Emily Arnold Fernandez, Executive Director of Asylum Access. Thank you for being with us. And thanks, Sky Fitzgerald, Director of Spin Film. His new documentary is called Lifeboat. And once again, it will be screened tomorrow, that's Wednesday, at 7:30 at the Landmark Embarcadero in San Francisco. And thank you, our listeners. We're with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. I know, I see the whole Zoll family here. I must have got choked up for that reason, losing my voice. Thank you for being with us. We're here with you 9 to 11, Monday through Friday, an hour repeated in the evening. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.